Michael Pennington has long been associated with Chekhov. Sometimes he seems almost synonymous with him. His presentation of the playwright, with extracts from his writing, private and public, has been seen all over the world and adapted for radio and television since the first version of it was produced by the National Theatre in 1984. Now, to celebrate the 150th anniversary of Chekhov's birth, he's put together a week of events at Hampstead Theatre involving starry names from the worlds of literature and theatre, including, amongst others, Richard Eyre and Michael Frayn, Rosamund Pike, Lynn Truss, David Hare, Penelope Wilton and Simon Russell Beale. Well, while the week is celebratory, it's also part of a campaign to save Chekhov's last house, the White Dacha, in Yalta. My name's Heather Neal, of a Theatre Voice, and Michael Pennington's with me now between rehearsals at Hampstead, where we've both managed to get here through virtually Russian-type snow. Anyway, Michael, you've dedicated a good deal of your time to Chekhov, and he's a wonderful playwright, of course, but there's more to it than that, isn't there? There's something about this man which is extra special, isn't there? And he's virtually adored in England.
Yes, he is, and I was very flattered by your comment that I was synonymous with Chekhov. Well, that would be quite something. The curiosity, as far as I'm concerned, is that though I've loved the plays for as long as I've loved plays, as most theatre people do, my angle of approach to Chekhov perhaps is not primarily to do with the plays, because, in fact, I've not been in them very much. I've done The Seagull twice over the years, and The Three Sisters twice also, but I've not done Vanya or The Cherry Orchard. So it's not to do with endlessly playing Chekhov that I, you know, feel as strongly about him as I do. Nor, in a funny way, though I equally adore the stories, which are magnificent.
All 600 of them?
Perhaps not all 600 of them, but in their various ways they're entirely Chekhovian. Yeah. It's not even that. There is, what interests me, and always has done, is him as a man, or rather the man that was the writer. And without becoming, it's difficult to speak of without becoming rather sentimental, but his position in one's life, the example that he sets, the inspiring figure that he was in this short, cruelly abbreviated life of 44 years, what he achieved apart from his famous achievements, working tirelessly as a doctor, all the social work he did, both in European Russia and indeed right across Siberia to a penal colony off the east coast of Russia, his indefatigable letter writing, his support of other writers, his palpable goodness, so extreme that it's actually almost an obligation to try and find something wrong with him, or try and find some foible or you know, selfishness. That you can find them. So I have an intense curiosity about him as a man, and therefore naturally about the plays. The week at Hampstead, which, as you say, is, I think, going to be a splendid thing, is sort of riven with Chekhovian ironies, because, first of all, if more Russian snow comes down as it has in the last few days, no one will be able to get to the theatre anyway, which would be a real shame. And also because it's based on a Chekhovian paradox. First of all, the pleasure that one feels thinking this is near enough his 150th birthday, but on the other hand, the anxiety that, unless something is done, the future of his final and most characteristic house in Yalta, his dacha in Yalta is what I mean to say, is going to decline into a state where neither it nor his spirit within it is going to be available to anybody. So it's a bittersweet occasion, and I hope we come out on the sweet side.
Well, you're going to be doing your show, of course, on Saturday afternoon at the end of the week. But how did you put it together? Was it mainly a case of getting in touch with all the people you thought might be interested? Of course, your address book must be very useful to you. But did you then ask people to take a line that they particularly found interesting, or was there an overarching theme?
In a way, the genesis, if that's not too grand a word for the whole week, came from my friend Dr. Rosamund Bartlett, who's a tremendous biographer and translator of Chekhov. We'd got to know each other very frequently, and, you know, being summoned together for radio programs to make comments about Chekhov, events that we would duly arrive at with files of notes and folders, hoping that we'd have the chance to talk for half an hour. And in fact, we would be asked for a sound bite each on one subject. So it was, you know, we were sort of mutually frustrated at having to, you know, being so heavily sub-edited, you might say, when we were on the radio.
Although radio is going to make up for it somewhat in the next.
Oh, yes, I think whatever debt might have been thought to have been due is going to be repaid, certainly. And she and William Fiennes, in fact, and I were sitting around at some festival, literary festival not so long ago, and Rosamund said, you know, Chekhov's 150th birthday, and Will is a good Chekhovian as well, so well, that's marvellous. Couldn't we get some little venue, you know, and have some writers, favourite writers, to come and talk about their favourite short story? They made the mistake of saying this in the hearing of a showbiz person, because I thought, well, maybe we could go further with this and find a proper theatrical venue in London, and maybe I can sell the idea. I had an idea that Hampstead had a week free at this point. It's in fact the last week of Anthony Clark's tenure as artistic director at Hammond. He's a dear friend, so, and it happens that the week is free, so I called him up and said, could you give us the week to do a sort of festival? And he seemed very pleased to do that. Well, he is very pleased to do it, I think. So the thing sort of immediately blossomed into something bigger than I think Will or Rosamund originally thought. As you say, a man of my age has a big address book, and the thing is you just start calling people. And what is extraordinary is that you don't get any refusals, except for reasons of availability. If people are free, why wouldn't you do an evening on Chekhov? He commands such love and respect within our profession as out of it, that it would be a strange person who said, well, I am free on that night, but I don't want to come and talk about Chekhov. I don't want anything to do with Chekhov. Absolutely not at all. Even actors who are the most cautious about booking themselves up, especially for an event which is unpaid and depends entirely on goodwill, said, you know, whatever happens, whether I get a film or something like that, I will do my absolute utmost to be there. Because I then had to calculate the probability of that, you know, so that the whole question of print deadlines and so forth, you know, would be okay. And touch wood, I've been extraordinarily lucky. There'd been no emergencies of any significance at all. And it's been, insofar as such an exercise can be easy, very easy to do. The question of whether there was an overarching idea, no, not really. Except to celebrate and draw attention to the state of the house. And the drawing attention to the state of the house is something that Rosamund and I will deal with as the hosts of the evening, as it were, leaving the writers and actors to get on with what they most want to do. Mm. And it's interesting because in a funny way, each evening is beginning to reflect the temperament of the individual writer in a certain way. And they're becoming very, very varied. Some are very simple, an evening in which a writer will speak about a short story and then the actor will simply read it. Others will, there'll be six, seven people on the stage, as in Richard Eyre's acting workshop, which is going to cover all four of the major plays. Yes. With a little, which
also includes Harriet Walter and Lisa Harriet Dillon
Walter,
as well as
Lisa
you.
Lisa Dillon and Tom Burke. Oh. So we have a little company of four, yeah, to deal with the whole of Chekhov. Michael Frayn's evening on the Monday, which is going to concentrate appropriately enough on the early stages of Chekhov's career, when he wrote these sensational one-act plays and farces, the vaudevilles, as he called them, some of which are known, like The Proposal and The Harmfulness of Tobacco, others of which originated as short stories, but Michael Frayn has adapted them, so they'll be less familiar. But once again, with a group of actors, which in this case is Steve McNeil, myself, Miriam Margolyes, and David Horovitch.
And there's a premiere, isn't there?
That's a premiere. It's somewhere embedded in there is a little premiere of a very short piece that was going to be performed in one of Michael's evenings before, called Plots. The piece called Plots is the evening. It was called The Sneeze. So that's our little, the cherry on our cake that night. And the only other sort of theatrical event is my own matinee of my own show on a Saturday afternoon. So it is varied, and I think sufficiently varied, and I think we've covered, you know, as far as you can, just about everything. What strikes me is you could do the whole thing all over again the next week with different people, because the response has been fantastic.
Yes, and the format for most of the other evenings will be a writer talking about some one or two or more short stories, which will be read by an actor or more.
Yes, sometimes first, sometimes second.
Yes.
It's entirely up to them.
Yes.
And how they weave in and out of it, how much they involve the actor in the discussion. How much they would, writers welcome discuss my and Rosamund Bartlett's involvement, because we're there on the premises and perhaps
will there be video recordings, or will there be
actually shown, do you mean?
Well, available at some point.
I mean, the programme?
Of the whole thing, because I'm sure more people would like to see it than we'll be able to.
I haven't planned it. I wonder. The entrepreneurial spirit is starting. I know the complexity of that in terms of rights and royalties and all the rest of it, so I would have to speak to a specialist. But, you know, either we'll do it or it'll be one of those theatrical evenings that people say, oh, there's no record of it.
Yeah.
Of course, one's life
there.
And career is littered with such things. That, but can't I see it? Can't I see it? I said, no, we did it in 1978. You can't see it.
Yes. Well, it is not quite like that anymore, generally, is it? But...
yes, more things get recorded. But and get archived too. I mean, many theatres archive all their stuff. Not that you can get at it for, again, reasons of permission. But
the National Theatre's opened up quite a lot. But
have they? Well, I'll look into it. Thanks for the tip.
Well, we really ought to talk about this house as well. Chekhov lived there from, was it 1899 to 1904?
Yeah, when he died.
And then he left it. He didn't actually die there.
No.
But. And it sounds rather amazing. He actually had it built, didn't he?
He moved down to Yalta, I think, in 1898. In other words, the
knowing he had.
Very much so. He was officially diagnosed with tuberculosis in 1897, which was also the moment when he had a terrible, what would the word be, a terrible fit of coughing and a hemorrhage, in the Slavyansky Bazaar Hotel in Moscow in front of his friend.
Suvorin,
his publisher, appropriately enough. But that was only a confirmation of something he'd known, certainly since 1890, when he travelled across Siberia to Sakhalin in conditions of the most terrible discomfort, naturally.
That was the penal colony.
He visited a penal colony off the East Coast because he'd heard that things were amiss with it in terms of the treatment of the convicts. Interviewed 10,000 convicts in 3 months, wrote a card index on each and every one of them. And it took him 3 months to get there. You can imagine, travel across Siberia in 1890. And this was a man who sensed already at the age of, whatever, he'd be 30, that he was not well. And as a doctor, he would well know what was wrong with him. He did his best to conceal it from himself and others for the next few years. But in 1897, the diagnosis was unavoidable. And down to the Crimea he went in 1898. He knew the area. In fact, he comes from the south. Originally, they're not from that particular part. And he'd always said he hated Yalta because it's full of consumptives and people treating them, so there's a paradox for you.
And they did actually come to him, didn't they?
They did. When he was there. They did. It was the big unofficial TB clinic in the country at the time. So he then designed, commissioned, oversaw a house up on the hills above Yalta, which is indeed the White Dacha. Which is why it has such a particularly personal feeling to it, of course. His last 5 years in Yalta must have been the most wretched of his life. It's not as if it was beautiful as the place is. The beauty was very much in contrast to his state of mind as he realised his life was shortening. But it also produced Three Sisters, Cherry Orchard, short stories like The Bishop, and most famously Lady with a Little Dog, all of which, apart from being masterpieces, have some element in them of characters wishing to be somewhere other than they are, which is most conspicuously the Three Sisters wanting to be in Moscow. And that was absolutely true of Chekhov. I mean, he didn't like it down there. He loved the wheat fields of northern Russia. He loved Moscow. So he was in exile. And the only thing really that redeemed the exile was his developing relationship with Olga Knipa, whom he ultimately married, who, of course, would come and see him. But it was a big journey, and it was an even bigger journey, in a sense, for him to travel to Moscow, where she was working. And so that was the relief for him, but most of his life was miserable, and one should perhaps remember that. You know, it's a beautiful-looking place, and he had a beautiful house, and the house, it's idyllic in a way, but it wasn't, in fact, idyllic for him at all.
And he was separated from Olga a good deal of the time,
very
of course,
much so, because their deal, which he insisted on, though you may have come to regret it, was that she would continue to work as an actress in Moscow, giving life to his characters, while he really had to stay down there, otherwise his health would suffer badly. So what with the travel, long distances, they didn't see each other much at all. The tragic irony is that having, as it were, insisted on this arrangement, because he was an independent man. He always said he wanted a wife like the moon who wouldn't be there in the sky every day. He needed her more and more as time went on. So that's the tragic paradox of it, I suppose, is what you'd say.
And they wrote, of course. There's famous
and very moving correspondence. Moving not only because of their love and affection for each other, but because of the underlying paradox of their situation, I think, and the sort of struggle within it. And it's, you know, like Chekhov's writing, extremely endearing. Mm. We don't have her letters in such profusion, of course, but we have his, and they're of course endlessly anthologized, and indeed many shows have been based on them, many theatre shows. They're one of the famous correspondences, for sure. The house itself is a beautiful white house surrounded by gardens, which are big gardens. They're almost the size of botanical gardens. I was surprised when I went there how big they were.
Mm. And he planted a lot of trees.
You could still see the trees he planted, some of them, including cherry trees. One of the fearsome possibilities now, of course, is that because the status of the land around the house is not very clear, the legal status since the changes in Russia, nobody's quite sure who owns it. So it's not inconceivable that a speculator might come and buy the land, chop down the cherry trees, and build holiday homes right next to the house, and that may ring a bell with Chekhov enthusiasts. It could actually happen. It's relatively unlikely, because, you know, of course the house is treasured there up to a point, but it's not ever going to be a big tourist attraction because it's quite difficult of access, and the whole funding of it is what's, you know, in dispute at the moment.
But because it is in Ukraine, but
it's exactly where it always was, of course, but since the changes in Russia, it's now an independent Ukraine. So the Russians are saying, well, right, okay, then it's a Ukrainian problem, Chekhov's house. Not that they talk about it a great deal. The Ukrainians are saying, but this was a famous Russian writer, although he had Ukrainian blood in him. So you could see a perfect formula for two governments to pass the buck and drop it between them. I mean, and that's candidly what seems to have happened.
And fewer people have been visiting it recently, isn't that right?
It had a very severe decline. I should just mention in this context that it does get some state support from a little area. It's rather complex. It's called the Crimea Autonomous Region, where it actually sits, which is within the Ukraine. But they're a very small organization, and it's increasingly come to depend on private donations, which is an issue because the house is beginning, there's some subsidence, there are cracks appearing, or have been. All sorts of problems have arisen. The staff don't know if they're going to be paid. That situation has been arrested to some extent. Between 2003 and 2007, there was a serious decline. Since 2007, there's been much more awareness everywhere of this, and more one-off donations have been made by various bodies, both in Russia and abroad. So there is some progress. However, what they still don't have there is any form of contingency for the future as to paying the staff, making sure that when things come up, they can pay for it. I mean, they'll be able to pay for the emergency plumber, if you see what I mean.
Yes.
So it's not satisfactory, you know, to wait till a problem comes and then look for money to solve it. They need some kind of underlying security, which they had in the Soviet Union times and no longer have.
Well, perhaps we should go back a little bit, because he lived there with his sister, Masha, and his mother.
That's
until
right,
his mother died, didn't he? And then, his mother died after
his
he did, in fact.
Him, yes,
she outlived him too. And Masha lived until 1957, I think.
Into the 50s, yes.
So, and managed to defend the house from the Nazis during the occupation.
She did.
She sounds a very, very strong and dedicated person.
I think she became so. Her life, when Chekhov was alive, was very subservient to him. And this is where you begin to see some warts on the saintly face of Chekhov. He more or less prevented her having a life of her own in the sense of a family life. She was a very talented painter, and in every way an attractive woman, I think. But he saw all the suitors off. He didn't want her marrying. He wanted her there to look after him. And then when he met Olga Knipa late in his life, he wanted to be looked after by both of them. And he even went so far as to marry Olga without telling Masha that he'd done it. I mean, this is not very noble. And I like the story, I must say, because it just counteracts, you know, the idea of Chekhov. He, you know, he was full of all the usual kind of male cowardice, to quite a high degree, I should say. So Masha's life with him was not so easy. But with him gone, she became, and it's a very Russian thing, this, she became the guardian of the flame. And specifically, of course, the guardian of the house. Olga was no longer really involved with the house. She sort of inherited the Chekhov theatrical legacy, you might say, in Moscow, with the Moscow Art Theatre. But Masha looked after the house, turned it into the museum, defended it furiously. There's a story, which may or may not be apocryphal, that when the Nazis occupied the house, she refused to let the commander of that particular regiment or division or whatever it was sleep in Chekhov's bedroom. More substantially, and this is an unsettling story, the house ultimately came under Nazi protection because the wife of a nephew of Chekhov's, also called Olga Chekhova, like his wife, became one of Hitler's favorite actresses, and used her privileged position to ensure that the house in Yalta was protected and nobody in the Chekhov family was touched. So this is a highly, it depends on your point of view, doesn't it? But it's a highly ambiguous event, and it led to Marcia becoming very much condemned in Yalta itself. She had privileges that ordinary people didn't have. She could go to the beach and other people couldn't, and all this sort of thing. And she was protected, and the house was protected too. There you are. So that's the historical truth of the matter. Mm-hmm. The sort of watered down version is that she refused to let the officer sleep in the bedroom.
Right.
That's the one you prefer to think about.
All we can think of now is that we're glad that for whatever reason
the Nazis accidentally did a good thing in that respect.
Well, you've actually been there, haven't you?
I have, just recently.
Yes. What does it feel like to go in there? For a start, you say it's difficult to access. So
well, it is.
The journey's difficult.
Yes. You have to fly to Kiev in the Ukraine, and you have to get another flight to Simferopol, which is in the Crimea, and then you're still an hour and a half's drive to Yalta. So you either have to go by boat or hire a taxi, which is not like hiring a taxi at the Ritz, let's say. Mm. And then you get there. So it's a difficult place to reach. And
did Chekhov get there by train?
Train.
Yes.
Yeah, train.
But you can't anymore.
No, curiously enough, can't. You can't. I'm wrong. He would go by train, I think, to Sebastopol, which is round the corner.
Yes.
And then I think he would need to take a steamer.
Yeah.
I think that's right, from
around
Sebastopol,
around
the coast to Feodosia, which is near Yalta. So that would have been how he did it. So there probably never has been a railway line all the way down there. So it's actually hardly, well, jet travel, of course, but it's still very difficult to reach. The Russians love the Crimea, and it is extraordinarily beautiful. We're not much conscious of it. It's a long way away, but it's the most beautiful part of the world, and has always, since Catherine the Great's time, and certainly in the Tsar's time, been, you know, a great watering hole for the aristocracy. So that's interesting. There are three main Chekhov residential sites in Russia. One is a little flat in Moscow, in which he lived when he first went to Moscow. The other is at Melikovo, which is about 50 miles south of Moscow, where he went when he first achieved a bit of success.
Cherry trees there too, weren't there?
Yes, they've all been destroyed. I mean, the house has very largely been destroyed, and therefore, well, the polite word is restored, but to a large extent rebuilt, I'm afraid. So although you do get something at Melikovo in terms of Chekhov, it's not what you get in Yalta, which was his later home. He moved to Melikovo because he was a success, and he was so pleased with himself because he was doing what Tolstoy and Turgenev and everybody had done, just buy a country estate. But his reasons, as we've discussed, for going to Yalta were more melancholy. But to me, of course, as an enthusiast, it's to complete the hat trick of his three premises is a great thrill. And it is quite different because it has been kept absolutely as it was. Obviously, there's had to be some repairs. But it's been very, very authentically done, very, very faithfully done. The layout of his study, you can see why it was done as it was. He was a man in poor health. He could sit at his desk, and there was a sofa, a couch immediately behind the chair he sat on, so he could literally fall onto the sofa if he needed to rest. And that was significant. There's a picture of him lying there, a very distressing picture. His bedroom was just off the study, very, very close indeed. The whole house is laid out for someone who, in a discreet way, had required economy of effort.
Mm. Is it true that he could fish from sitting on...
He said so, but I think it's a Chekhovian
bit of
fib. He did tell a lot of fibs. I mean, he has a story that when Uncle Vanya was a success in Moscow, and he also, I should say, owned one of the very first private telephones in the area. Yeah. He was thrilled with that and said it was great because he could talk on the telephone to Tolstoy, which even in Russian is slightly alliterative, though not as alliterative as it is in English. And he was rung from Moscow by the Moscow Art Theatre when Varney was a success. You can imagine the drunken calls from the cast from the restaurant afterwards. And he said, I went to bed and fell asleep, and then the telephone rang and I had to get up and run through the house and answer it and receive congratulations. Then I go back to bed, drop off again, then the telephone would ring again. Now, I can tell you that the telephone was, I would say, about 6 or 7 paces from his bed. It wasn't that tough, but he would have you believe that he'd run down corridors. I mean, it's very funny because you catch him out now, many years later, in a small self-dramatizing fib. Yeah. And so I don't see how he could have fished out of the window. No, he can't have fished out of the window. It's not possible. It's just one of the things he said for mischiefs, like that the cherry orchard should run for, last act should run for 12 minutes, not 40.
But has being in his study actually helped you with your... in your show, do you think?
It always has done. I mean, there are interesting things about that study. One is that his dear friend Isaac Levitan, the painter, much less well known here than he should be, but a great, legendary Russian painter who is very much the painterly or visual equivalent of Chekhov's writing. His studies of Russian landscapes are just marvellous, especially northern Russian landscapes. And he used to visit Chekhov in Yalta, though he was dying himself, in fact. And there was apparently a night when Chekhov was becoming very nostalgic for, you know, northern Russia. And Levitan called Masha, of course, the faithful Masha, to provide some board and got out his paints and painted this study of haystacks in the moonlight, which looks very much like a Monet. Mm. But it has an air of hurry about it. And that was hung up above the fireplace, well, the stove, immediately opposite Chekhov's desk. And you can see the pictures of it and him standing beside it. And you can still see the pictures of it without him standing beside it. So it's still there in the same position as it was put that day, whether it's been taken down for cleaning or what. So, of course, that has a frisson to it. Mm. I also have a picture of him, of Chekhov, standing in another corner of the room next to a strange object, which is like a sort of large wardrobe, but very sort of garishly decorated on the outside. I never quite work out what it is, and he's leaning against the wall, not looking very well. And I've now seen that object for myself, and it's just a rather elaborate piece of furnishing. The thing that stops you getting too sentimental about this is, and I must emphasize, they're wonderful people who look after the house, but there is an element of the official line that goes on. Also in that corner of the room, there's a most hideous model of a Russian village, and a ghastly sort of box, a sort of great mahogany box. And the guide will tell you that these were Chekhov's proud possessions that the Moscow Art Theatre gave him after the first night of the Cherry Orchard in 1904, and he kept here. Now, I know, and anybody who reads his letters and accounts know, that the first night of the Cherry Orchard in 1904 was an evening of the most exquisite pain to him, not just physical, because although the play was good enough, they made a big party for him and gave him these presents and made speeches, and he simply detested it, and he detested the presents and said as much in letters. So you have to nod politely when the guys tell you that. Just as there's a wonderful woman who's in her 90s now, who's worked at the museum, as it now is called, since the 1950s. Now, in the 1950s, Masha Chekhov's sister was still alive. So this woman knew Masha Chekhov, and it's one of those moments when your sense of history jolts as you shake her by the hand. You shook Masha Chekhov's hand as well. And I perhaps made the mistake early on of saying to her, apropos of Masha, I said, of course, you know, everyone knows there was a little bit of tension, wasn't there, between Masha, the sister, and Olga, the wife. There's a little bit of understandable tension. Nyet, nyet, nyet. She said, absolutely not. There's no question of that at all. She said, Masha and Olga loved each other at first sight. Anton Pavlovich was such a dear, kind man. He made sure that everyone was happy in his life. But this is just not true.
No.
This is not true. And the reason they were at odds with each other, not horribly at odds, but there was tension, was largely because Chekhov had this tendency to back out of any kind of confrontation and let them fight it out. So you do encounter this.
And there was the mother as well, wasn't there?
There was the mother who one tends to forget in all of this. Mm-hmm. She has a little room at the top of the stairs, which, by the way, is next to a glass cabinet in which Chekhov's boots and leather coat in which he crossed Siberia hang, as well as his floppy hats and his ties and his shirts that you can see in the photograph. So once again, you have this sort of frisson. But on the same floor, there's a very monastic-looking little room with a single bed and icon on the wall, which was indeed Evgenia's, his mother, about whom history is quite silent. I think he was devoted to her. She outlived him. She died in 1919, I think, so she outlived him by 15 years. The father was the problem in that family, and he died before Chekhov did. I think Evgenia was a quiet and devout person who took great pride in Chekhov's career. And when the Moscow Art Theatre brought Uncle Vanya down to Sebastopol on tour, largely in a way so that Chekhov could see it, his mother turned up, put on what Chekhov described as a terrible old tattered silk dress and sat in a box, and he was terribly embarrassed about it. Or rather, he said how sentimental it was, which is his way of saying how embarrassing, I think. So she's this quiet presence throughout and beyond his life. And what's one of the things that's impressive in the house is the sense of him thinking what would be best for her, where should we put her room and how should it be. And he put, by the same token, Marcia, the sister, he put, gave her almost the whole of the top floor of the house, which is flooded with light because she was a very good painter, and that was obviously the best place for her. His study, in fact, that could potentially also be flooded with light, except that it's got diamond stained glass on it with colours, which the effect of which would have been to diffuse the otherwise very bright light coming through from the bay, because it's right near the bay. Outside Chekhov's study, there's a balcony, and half a story up just next to it, or it feels like half a story rather than a whole story, is Marcia's balcony out of her bedroom. So a little bit like in Kanolkar's Private Lives, you can imagine the two of them stepping out on the balcony, having really quiet, gossipy conversations between them about all the visitors in the house. Because Chekhov had an attitude to visitors which was part welcoming and partly dreading. I mean, he both loved and welcomed them on the one hand, but also wanted them to go quite often. And they would have done all the household business from their two balconies. So there's very much, and they're also, the common parts of the house are very, very welcoming. You know, the hallway into which you step is like a big welcoming room. If you go into a party there, you'd immediately feel at home. So there's a very good balance between the common parts and, you know, the private quarters of every member of the family. You sense a very sensitive person designing them.
Well, I don't think we should end without mentioning the dogs, because they have such wonderful medical names, doctors' names. Yeah. They were called...
He had a number of dogs through his life. I mean, it was a dog's life in those days to be a dog in Russia, because... also, you know, they'd be killed in the night, they'd disappear. But he was, in his earlier years, he had a dog called Quinine and a dog called Bromide. And the pictures of him, some people will know this, there's a picture of him sitting on the front steps of his house in a big coat. He's got his stick and he's leaning at an angle. He's got one of the dogs, which I think is Quinine, I could be wrong, I did identify it once, under his arm, and they were little dachshunds. And he loved them very much, but of course he gave them these strange names. Now, quinine and bromide means more to them than it does to us, but it's a bit like calling a dog arsenic and morphine. It's not a very cheery name for a dog. But he had that habit, apparently, that all dog lovers, all pet lovers have, of anthropomorphizing the dogs. And he would spend long evenings in company, giving them little voices and having conversations with them in the most childish way, you know, little dialogues between Anton Pavlovich and Quinine. And Pavlovich and Bromide. So, you know, he was a dog lover to a fault. They would all come to sticky ends, these dogs, and he had more, but of course he also called his wife his dog. You know, I'm afraid it's also quite Russian, this. I mean, he called her a crocodile, he called her his you know, affectionate names were crocodile, dog, dolphin, I don't know what, I can't even remember, but it was like a menagerie if you read his letters. And one of the things was, I'm afraid he called her a dog, at least it was the male form, not the female.
Well, of course, he could see from his study the promenade along which the lady with the little dog walked, couldn't he? So,
and you still can.
And that can be heard this week, read by Penelope Wilson.
That's right.
So I think perhaps we should end there. Let's just remind people that they can get tickets by going to hampsteadtheatre.com for this week. And for information about Chekhov's house, yaltachekhov.org. Thank you very much, Michael.
Thank you.